You're listening to the Authentic Success Podcast, episode number 4. I'm Sean Tuttle at The Natural Professional. Natural, as in authentically you. Professional, as in being recognized and supported for systematically making a positive impact in your sphere. It's been almost 2 years since the last episode of this podcast. And let me tell you, it is not from a strong desire to be doing it. I love this medium. I absolutely love it. The initial impetus for getting the podcast going was that I was going to the Wisdom 2.0 conference. And my goal was to either identify or interview 5 people that spoke at the conference or that I met at the conference. I even did my homework ahead of time, and I set up the first interview with Tammy Simon to happen there at the conference. And then I did another one also. So Kelly McGonigal, I interviewed her at the conference as well. And then I did arrange for 3 more. So I did the first 3, Tammy, Kelly, and Irene Au. And then I interviewed the 4th person, and the interview, I don't know, I didn't love it. I didn't think it was that fabulous. And the order of the interview just came out weird. And so I found myself doing all this editing and rearranging so that it would make some sense in some form of story. And it ended up not happening. I never finished it. And then the 5th person that I was going to interview, I still plan on it because he's an amazing resource for neuroscience, but I wanted to read his book first so that I would be coming to him with, you know, a good amount of research and understanding his perspective better and have more informed and intelligent questions. And it was a really big book and I never really finished it. And I never outreached to him again to do it. So being something of a perfectionist, I stuck, you know, there was this thing in my head. And so here's this aspect of knowing oneself and looking back and seeing patterns. And these are the patterns that I see in myself. So I had originally set this intention to interview 5 people that I had met at Wisdom 2.0. 3 of them, great. 2 more, having some problem. There were some difficulties. There was a roadblock. And so there's this part of me that's like, well, you can't continue until you finish these 2, which of course is absolutely ridiculous. But that was the story looking back that was going through my head. A couple months go by and the perfection tendency starts making way towards shame, really, you know, embarrassment. It's like, oh my God, you know, I talked to these people and it just, you know, it snowballs. It gets really silly. But then the other aspect that happened was life. And that year in 2012, I started feeling some other very strong feelings involving desiring a big change, wanting to really just flip my life upside down and change how I had been living, which ended up meaning wrapping up my life in my town of Nevada City and renting out my house and going location independent. So by February of the next year, I was in Mexico. I was in Mexico and I was there for 4 months. And then I was back in the US for several months and went, you know, up to the World Domination Summit conference and then took off for Thailand. And so I just got back from 3.5 months in Thailand. And so all this time I'm thinking about the podcast. And last fall, I took on a team member, Kathy Frey, who is helping me with all kinds of marketing stuff and helping me from myself. And poor Kathy just had to listen to me over and over again talking wistfully about the podcast that I was going to start up again and how much I love doing it. And but it never quite made it up the priority list. And so 2 weeks ago, we're talking about the order of things. And she says, well, what about the podcast? You know, just like real casually. And oh my God, was she sneaky. She just throws it out there. Hey, what about the podcast? And it's been so long that I immediately went back into this like place. And this is another one of my patterns and habits that I see. And I also see other people doing. So I'm going to throw it out there. And that's this kind of ridiculous puritanical work ethic, meaning that you have to do the hard stuff before you do the fun stuff. And to me, the podcast is pure, unadulterated fun. It's, oh my God, such a beautiful way to connect with people and to see what they're up to and to learn more about the world through their perspective. I absolutely love it. And so when she says, hey, how about the podcast? I said, well, you know, I think we should get the guest blogging down first and then go on to the podcast. And the significance of that is that I'm just having issues with blogging right now. Like I'm just not having that much fun of it. So my default was to go back to the work, to the pain, before I can have the fun and the dessert of the podcast. And she totally called me on the floor and was like, why? I love how once ready, we can listen to our friends. And for those who listen to us tell these stories that don't necessarily make sense, and call us on them. And I'm so grateful that I was finally at a place and ready to listen. And, you know, she's probably pretty happy about that too. So here we are, episode number 4. And we'll be at least back on a monthly publishing schedule, hopefully more than that. But I'm, wanting to set a realistic goal here. And I'm so thrilled that our first conversation, my first conversation back on the podcast at the mic is with poet Molly Fisk. I've known Molly for several years. She's been living in Nevada City much longer than I have been. And we knew each other kind of peripherally. And then we were both a part of this group of women. It turned out to be this crazy, wild weekend of going to Reno. We're only about an hour from Reno to go hear Jill Bolte Taylor speak, you know, the neuroscientist who had the brain tumor. And I mean, one, Jill's talk was just phenomenal. It was fantastic. And this group of women, oh my God, we just had a blast and a half. So that was my first, you know, really kind of in-depth connection with Molly. And then she signed up for my 6-week organizing class. So from then on, I'm thrilled that we've been able to call each other friends. In this conversation, we talk about marketing authenticity, knowing yourself in the context of recovery time that enables you to stay in a place of productivity and creativity, and how to listen to yourself in the context of making important decisions for your business. So let's get to it. I'm so thrilled to be talking with Molly Fisk today, and I wanted to have Molly on the show to explore the space of creativity and inner listening in a professional context. So a little just the background deets on Molly. She's a published poet. She's got 3 books of poetry and has been featured in several anthologies. She's won several fellowships, such as from the National Endowment for the Arts, poetry prizes, and a grant from the Corporation of Public Broadcasting. And she's even appeared in a documentary, which is very exciting. She runs a poetry boot camp. She's a writing teacher, a radio commentator whose show has been syndicated to several stations across the U.S. She's got a published book of that radio commentary and 2 CDs of radio essays with a new book based on one of those coming out in July. And to add a whole other twist to the mix, she's a certified Skills for Change coach. Molly, welcome, and thanks so much for talking today.
Thank you. I'm glad to see you.
Yeah, it's been a while after. So for a little bit of reference, I've been doing the location independent stuff and I'm back in Nevada City. So we get to sit here together on your couch instead of doing this over Skype with a couple of, well, one anyway. I know you've got a few cats, and so we may get to hear a bit from them today, too.
They have many opinions.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. So I wanted to add one more item to your list of accomplishments, and that is an observation expert. The nuances of daily life that you capture in your commentaries and your poetry always leaves me wanting to look at the world a little more closely.
Yay.
Yeah.
Good.
Your perspective on...
Bless you.
Excuse me.
A perspective on just from big picture things to the small details of, you know, light coming through the window or whatever it is just beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I feel like that's my strong suit. So it applies everywhere.
Okay.
Yeah. And I was a kid, my mom was a painter, and she would, you know, when we were all kids, she would take us on walks and she'd say, okay, how many colors of green can you see? Or she'd go over to a leaf and turn it upside down and say, look what the back is really interesting too. And so I get that.
Which just fills me with total hope that this is a little bit of a learned skill.
Oh, yeah. Oh. I think you have to practice. I think you can learn to do anything if you practice. And the question is, do you want to practice enough? I do not want to learn again how to change the oil in my car. I would rather have somebody else do it. But I'm learning how to paint right now, which is very fun. Not something I ever was trained in. And it's exactly the same. You know, you think, your brain thinks, oh, I'll paint a leaf. And your brain thinks of a leaf and you're not looking at the actual leaf at all. Mm-hmm. And you have to train yourself to open your eyes more.
So I understand that you didn't get into writing poetry, I don't know if seriously is the right word, or there was a point around 35 years old. So maybe we can look at your background a little bit and just look at the evolution of your life. Because what I didn't mention in your list also is that you have an MBA. You are all over the map. You clearly have some left and right brain fusion going on.
Do-si-do-ing at least.
Do-si-do-ing, yeah. So maybe you could give a little... A little more background.
Sure. I was one of those people who was pretty good at things, but didn't ever know what she wanted to do. And so I did a lot of bouncing around when I was young. I was a sweater designer for a long time. I had majored in folklore and mythology in college. I'd lived in Norway for a year. I'd been knitting since I was 10. I liked it. So I sort of started this sweater company in Massachusetts. That was my first... endeavor. And then the company didn't really fly. I mean, I ran it for 10 years. It wasn't as successful as I thought it should be. And so I went to business school to find out why not.
Okay.
And then I thought, well, maybe business would be something that I might like. I mean, I liked going to business school. Great stories. So I became a banker. I moved to Chicago from Boston, became a Fortune 1000 lender.
Oh, wow.
To Midwestern manufacturing companies, which wasn't really my forte. And learned very clearly that business in that way was my second language. It wasn't my first. And I didn't know what my first was until I came to poetry when I was 35. And that was out of trauma. I found poetry because I was having a hard time. Somebody gave me a poem, and I hadn't read any contemporary poetry. And it just opened my world completely, and I tried doing it myself, and I was both able to and then was good at it. But I was never trying to be a poet. I mean, my God. A less remunerative, less well-supported by the culture.
Maybe your profession can tell you why.
I mean, you might want to be a stilt walker instead. You'd probably make more money. I came to writing by accident. But having said that, I had a famous writer in my family. And that's the other thing that I think applies here, is that when you have somebody really famous in your family, there isn't room for another person doing that same kind of work. So my uncle was John Updike.
Okay.
And he just, you know, he had covered all the bases and was as famous as anyone was going to get. And so other people didn't really try to be writers around him. But at the same time, the dinner table conversation was pretty fun and lively, and there's all this language flying around. And so I feel as though I got a great background for a writer, but it would never have occurred to me to become one.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So did you spend was he around?
I spent summers, my family spent summers with his family until we were all in college. So he was around a lot. But people have asked me, did he influence your work? And it's like, no. He was a grown-up and I was a kid, and that was always how it was, even when after I had grown up. Mm-hmm. You know, he was kind of part of the wallpaper of adults running around in my world when I was a kid. But he wasn't someone who was a good teacher or mentor, especially not for girls, I don't think. Mm-hmm. I did have an interesting job. He hired me in college to type. This is so old-fashioned, I can barely speak it into your microphone. So he had had a bunch of books printed in the States and then a bunch of versions printed in England. And some book of short stories had been printed in England, and he wanted to reprint it in the States. But it was in British English, and I had to translate it out of British English and into American English, which was both partly a spelling problem, where they spell theater R-E at the end instead of E-R.
Or color C-O-L-O-U-R.
Yeah, you're always pulling out all those little extra letters.
Uh-huh.
And then there were some, like they say, I think they say pullover when they mean sweater. There are things like that that are a little bit bigger. But so it was really fun. But, I'm using a regular old, I think, self-correcting tape had just come in, so I think I had a self-correcting Smith Corona typewriter.
Wow. And you just
and I did an entire book on that thing.
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, and he paid me very nicely, and that was fun, but it wasn't like he was helping me write, and I wasn't a writer, so it didn't matter.
Right, okay. So around 35, you started doing poetry as a tool for healing,
right,
and self-healing.
Right.
Okay. And then how did that get to publishing and to becoming a poet?
I wrote for about 6 months by myself and then thought, I just sort of wondered what it would be like to take a class. And then I took a class from Anne Lamott, who's not a poet. So I took one of her, this is slightly before, like 2 weeks before she got very famous. She was teaching a class at a church in Tiburon, and I took that. And through the people in that class, everybody said, oh, there's this great poet in Petaluma that you should go study with, and she's got some of the same trauma background that you do. And that was Dorianne Locks. So Dorianne was my first real poetry teacher.
Okay.
And she was very, she was a professional poet. She was teaching in her house and doing, you know, she wasn't working for a college then, although she got hired by the University of Oregon at Eugene about 4 years after I met her.
Hmm.
So I learned from her kind of what, and meeting all of her friends who are all fabulous poets. So the whole San Francisco poetry scene was suddenly open to me, and it was very fun. And for the first probably 4 years of writing, I was full and, you know, overflowing with poems. It was fabulous. So,
wow.
Yes.
Nice. So having, so in part what I'm hearing you say, so I'm starting to kind of bridge a little bit your experience also with business life.
Right.
And having a mentor, how important that is for opening doors and making introductions, but also showing you models of what is possible.
Right, right.
Do you feel like you would have ended up where you did as far as being published and winning awards and all that if you hadn't had a mentor?
Probably not. Although part of my trauma history was having to keep secrets. And so the conjunction of starting to write and then breaking that secrecy put me out. I had a lot of ambition might be the wrong word, but I had a lot of drive to tell my story. Mm-hmm. And I think that that helped a lot. And I was a type A back then, personality. So I was thinking, well, if I'm going to do this, I might as well win a prize for it. You know, what the heck? And
okay.
So I sent my work out a lot.
Okay. Okay.
And it doesn't, you don't win prizes unless you send your work out, it turns out. So. I learned that pretty fast.
Funny that.
It's very strange. They didn't come to your house. I've always been surprised.
So that must have been a huge indication to yourself as far as the efficacy of the poetry as a tool for healing, to get to the place where you're willing to put it out and be seen and be read on that larger scale.
Yeah.
That's, wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And then I turned around and started teaching, you know, 4 years into it or something ballsy like that, which is just how I do things.
Okay. Jump right in and go for it.
And it's, I've always just been entrepreneurial instead of anything else, so.
Right, okay. And so you became a teacher through that and ran boot camp and
yes,
had some...
invented things.
Okay.
Started a life as a poet. And I'm not, you know, I just should never be hired by anybody, really.
Oh, that's so true for so many of us.
I'm not good. I'm not a good candidate for the academic life because I would have to go to meetings and I would then start killing people. So
I see. Okay. Because so that is an option of a poet, is to basically get hired on to a faculty of,
right,
of some college or something.
Yeah.
I see.
Many, many poets do that. And there's a lot of back and forth about whether that's a good idea, whether it makes your poetry sound somehow homogenized with other academics, whether if you, you know, learn poetry in school, it's worse than learning it outside of school. Everybody's got an opinion about that.
Right.
But I'm not going to talk about that here. Such a big subject. Anyone else can talk about it.
Right. Got it.
But for me, I like working at home. I like inventing my own classes. I do a lot of work on the internet. And I've built kind of a nice little life.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, I will add, you have such a beautiful community online as well, which has been just a huge benefit, or one would think a huge benefit. So actually, let me ask you about that. So you are self-employed.
Mm-hmm.
So you get to call yourself a poet and self-employed.
Yep.
How has the internet changed that for you? You have this huge following on Facebook, really active. You put out a post and you get, you know, 10 minimum to usually like 20, 30, 40 responses 100. From people.
Yeah.
100. Yeah. People. Whew. Has that helped your business, or, you know, how is Facebook playing into that?
So let me give you a little bit of background. I was teaching classes in my living room in this little mining town where we are, Nevada City, California, in the late 90s and 2000, and I was making a reasonable living. And then 9/11 happened in New York. And my business died. Hmm. And I was so surprised. I mean, I still am surprised that something that happened that far away had such a huge impact on me. But people didn't want to go out at night anywhere in the country, and they didn't want to spend money. They hadn't lost it yet, as they lost it in 08, but they were just scared, and everybody stopped anything they were doing. And I was sitting around, and I actually had a student who became a friend, is still a friend. And we went to New Moon and had a nice brainstorming meeting over a cup of soup about how to take what I did out into the world farther than it had been.
Okay.
And I had been to the Squaw Valley Community of Writers writing workshop in the summer, I think twice by that time. And what they do is write a poem every day and then critique it the next morning in person up at 6,000 feet for a week. And I thought, we could do this online, no problem.
Oh, okay.
So I invited all my current students to do it online. By that time, 2001, almost everybody had email, even the 60 and 70 and 80-year-old people that are often my client base. They could all use plain old email. And so I started poetry boot camp that way. I did 1 week for free, and then I did 1 week and charged a little bit. And both of those weeks worked really well. And so then I built it into an actual online class. So before Facebook, which I didn't get on till 09, I had this network of poets. And it turns out that Facebook is a complete poet's clubhouse. I mean, I got on Facebook, and Dorianne and all these other poets whom I knew who were... had more books out than I did and were more famous, they all had 5,000 friends, which is the most that Facebook will let you have. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. And I could actually talk to somebody like Mark Doty or Marilyn Nelson or someone who I revere but would never call up. There they are on Facebook telling me what they had for lunch. You know, this is great. This is a sneaky way into everybody's life.
Right.
So I just took to Facebook like a fish.
Got it. And has it helped you gain more readers, more people signing up for your courses, more writing clients?
Yes, 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 yes. Everything. It's gotten me more reading gigs, more teaching gigs. More people have asked for my help in different and interesting ways, which sometimes I can give and sometimes I can't. Mm-hmm. I think I've probably, I don't really know how to estimate this, I've probably made $10,000 off of Facebook from getting teaching gigs, getting classes, and that's over like a 5-year period.
Got it.
Selling some of my new book, Blow Drying a Chicken. Facebook has been great for that.
Right. And it seems like in a fun way, because you don't push stuff. Like, I know your style, you do not push stuff on Facebook. And so it's just you living your life and communicating with people.
Right.
I mean, what better marketing is that? I mean, that's just like, yeah. You know, people are afraid of marketing. They're just like, oh, I don't want to do it, or it's hard, or whatever.
Well, I should send out more marketing materials than I do in order to get more people into my classes. I mean, there are some drawbacks that I'm working with, just because I feel like that marketing title is so annoying to everybody. Mm-hmm. But when I started on Facebook, I really carefully thought about it. So I don't market. I mean, I'll talk about a class I'm teaching. I'll make an event out of it. I'll tell people they might like it. But I keep that to 20% of my posts or fewer. I really don't want to overwhelm people with that, because I hate being sold to. Right. And I don't want Facebook to be a sales platform. Right. Even though it's wonderful as a sales platform. You should see the paintings that fly out of my house, because I put them on Facebook and say, does anyone want a painting of a barn? And then somebody says yes. It's so fun.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so you just brought up a great point of setting intention at the beginning of embarking upon a new strategy. So you said that when you started Facebook, you thought about what your strategy would be. So for example, less than 20% of the posts being direct sales.
Right.
Did you have any other parameters that you set for yourself, or goals or intentions that you set forth when you started on Facebook?
This was before the buzzword of authenticity had come into the business world, and transparency hadn't arrived yet either. But I think that part of my approach was, I am so sick of people pretending to be something they're not, of teachers getting in front of classrooms and acting as though they're better than the students, when in fact everybody's human. And the teacher knows more, or certainly knows more in a particular realm. But, you know, so I think I decided that I was going to be as open as I could stand. And there are vast tracts of my life that do not appear on Facebook, but nobody believes me when I tell them that. Because I'll start, you know, I'll suddenly talk about personal things. I'll talk about health stuff. I'll talk about, you know, different phases of life. I'll talk about relationships. I think probably the only mistakes I've made on Facebook is to get too emotional around relationship endings. And I just did that once, and then that taught me not to do it again, because I didn't. There's some things that happen on Facebook that you just need to avoid, and one of them is how people so much want to give you their advice.
Right.
So I try very hard not to put myself in a position where they're going to be wanting to give me some advice.
Right. Well, that seems to be a general cultural kind of trend.
Yes.
And push, you know, you say, oh, I'm having a something. And instead of us being present and saying, would you like some advice, or would you like me to just listen? Do you just want an ear? Do you want a shoulder to cry on? We jump into, well, have you crawled this person? Have you tried this? And, you know, here's this
zinc.
Book.
And, whoa. Vitamin C.
Yeah.
Arnica. Yeah.
Okay.
It's so fascinating, you know, the human wish to help. And
yes.
Fix. and be known for helping and fixing.
Yeah, right, right, right. Because isn't that one of the general trends, is be known as an authority.
Right, in some way.
Be an expert, which means for somehow we've translated that to be don't ask questions.
Which is nuts.
It's completely nuts. Yeah. Completely nuts.
Yeah.
Looking back at your development as a business person, so you started out, obviously, like you said, entrepreneurially with a sweater business, and then went into MBA banker land, and then became a self-employed poet. Many of us, and I know for me in particular, and I've heard other people say this as well, and I'm wondering if it's true for you, that you can learn some amazing things about yourself and how being in business is a wonderful opportunity for personal growth to run into our own self-limitations, whatever they may be. Have you found that to be... and be forced to deal with them in order to proceed.
Right, right.
Have you found that to be the case for you?
Completely, yeah. Okay. And, because we're not perfect people, it can sometimes take a while to believe that you're actually lacking in a particular skill and right. should beef it up. To believe that something that you don't know how to do is actually valuable. I mean, there are all sorts of sneaky ways that my brain and probably lots of other people's will just take a lot of time trying to convince me that everything's fine. I don't have to do all that work.
Right.
And of course you do.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some things like, I wonder if I can find a good example. Well, I am a self-taught poet. I have a good college education. I have a master's degree in business. I'm not stupid. But I'm also not at all drawn to long historical theoretical ideas. So when people have come to me to say, I want to work with you, I want you to be my mentor, and what I want you to do is help me go deeply into Dante's Inferno and read it together and understand it, and da 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 da. And it's like, that is the last thing you want to hire me to do, because already I hate the idea. And I like Dante, fine, but I don't want to have to be academic about something. I don't want to spend my time. I'm not good at that. Now, I have a friend who's very good at it, and so I just give them her phone number.
Right.
And that's the thing that I love about being an entrepreneur almost more than anything else, is that you get into this group of other people who are doing the same kind of work, and you know who's good at what, and you just pass people between you. I mean, there's so many people I refer out because what they're asking isn't something I either want to do or might be good at, and they should have somebody who's fabulous.
Nice. So you have that clarity within yourself.
Yes.
Which is awesome, because especially in the beginning parts of business, we're sort of encouraged to say yes to everything.
Right. And probably we're poor, too. So
well, there's that. which can go both ways, because if we say yes to too much of the wrong stuff being doesn't fit into my skill set or my interest area, if we say yes to too much of that, then we're not developing further skills and getting known in the areas that we do want to be known for.
Right.
So yeah, that financial...
But at the beginning, you don't always know what your skill set really is
true.
Or your interest area.
True.
So sometimes it can be great for somebody to give you a project and you're thinking, well, I don't know, let's see. If I like it, then I'll have learned something. And if I don't like it, then I'll have learned something. So
yes, yes.
The stretching and the practicing you can get as you're starting out, I think is wonderful.
And that's a different phase of the process.
Right.
So there's that questioning part. So this is one of the areas I'd like to kind of dive a little deeper, and that is decision making.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand that if one is unclear, so I don't know what my specialty is, I don't know what I particularly like or what people are willing to really pay for. I mean, those are all great questions when you're starting out. But as you get going, there are ways that you can somehow sense. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to know what those are for you, that this is a good fit for me. This is not a good fit for me. Therefore, I'm going to go in this direction or that direction. And it, in the moment, it is never that clear.
Yes.
So being out of, beyond that beginner phase, how do you hear in yourself what is a good direction, or this is, if it's not a crystal clear yes or no, how do you navigate the gray area in between the maybe? Is that a clear enough question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Usually with my body, usually I can feel an immediate reaction in my body, and I either don't pay attention to it or I do. And so if I have an intellectual maybe and my body has a response and I'm listening, that'll take me to a yes or a no. Some things you can look at and just obviously see, well, even if I don't really know, that's the direction I'm trying to go in. I want to work more with groups, even if I might feel like, well, I don't have that much experience. How are you going to get the experience unless you do the work? So it might feel scary, but you go in that direction anyway. Often, if I've got a maybe running through my head, that means no.
Mm, okay.
Often, I try to find only the really fierce yeses and follow that path.
Love it.
I'm 58. My dad died when he was 56. I'm an extremely famous poet within 12 miles of my house and somewhat known maybe 50 miles from my house. But I'm not as famous as I would like, and I don't have as many books out as I want to have out. I haven't written as many poems as I want to be writing. So part of my thinking also has to do with husbanding my time. It's like I'm not willing to screw around anymore. So whether it's professionally in terms of writing or for paid work, I feel as though I'm really much more careful than I was even 5 years ago.
Okay.
With my time. So I say no. For instance, in this town, I probably get invited to do 50 benefits a year, which would be me reading or emceeing or doing something on stage for free to benefit an organization. And of those 50, probably 47 I believe in. So that's the kind of town this is. But I only do 4 a year. And it took me a couple of years of doing almost 50 each year to think, this is crazy. Mm-hmm. And it's also not good. It's not good policy in the world. I mean, you need to have a lot of volunteering going on in this world to get the world to work. And that's traditionally been women's jobs, unpaid, keeping the world going. So I have opinions about that.
Right.
But I have some strong opinions about art and about asking artists to volunteer things. I mean, I'm willing to do that as long as people are willing to volunteer on behalf of artists in turn. So.
Right.
And just for me, I've only got 4 evenings a year that I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it makes people mad. It makes people very, you know, everybody's got their cause and everybody's working hard and they're probably volunteering. So yeah, they're probably mad that I'm not going to join them volunteering, but that's their decision, not mine.
Right.
And I've finally gotten used to making people mad and not minding.
Oh.
Which took me a while. Of course I want to help you. Of course I love you. Sure, Friday night. How many hours is it going to take? And
Right, right. Yeah. Which reminds me of a conversation that you and I had some time ago, and it was about either public speaking gigs or appearances of some sort and how much they take out of you. And I remember you saying that after a big event or endeavor like that, you take off. You know, you just take a significant amount of time and space to sort of recoup or come back into yourself. And you said, people have no idea how much time I take on my own to take care of myself.
Yeah.
So I would love to hear more about that, because in the world of online getting stuff done, that is not something that comes up very often.
Right.
And we don't take care of ourselves and we don't listen and we aren't tuned in to our body's communication. And I very much believe that it is and learning how to protect time for ourselves and to take it, that is how we're going to do business differently. Mm-hmm. So I would mm-hmm. love to hear more about in what situations you take that time and what you do for yourself.
So first of all, poets and writers and probably other artists, but I don't know as much about them. You can't just sit down and write a poem at 9 a.m. on a Monday morning. I mean, you can. It's possible to do it, and people do it. But you can't do that over and over and over again. That's not how writing works. For many of us, writing requires a certain amount of noodling around the house, not talking on the phone, not doing anything else constructive, looking out the window, walking around. Maybe you can do your laundry, but you have to be slow about it. You know, you have to leave the stuff in the dryer for a couple of hours. You can't be efficient because that's not how your brain works, gathering up information to be able to write. I am speaking for myself, but I've talked to so many people who feel this way too. So I started to get some practice taking care of myself in terms of giving myself a lot of extra time when I began writing in the early 90s. And then the more performing that I did and the more reading in public, speaking in public, the more I realized that afterwards I was kind of wrecked. Well, the first hint was actually that I could go do a reading in San Francisco, which is 3 hours from here. And most of the time I wanted to drive home afterwards. And I was totally full of energy. And I could make it home without any trouble. So at times when I used to plan to spend the night in San Francisco and then come home, I changed my habits around that because I had so much energy after doing a big performance or a reading. What I didn't really understand for a couple of years was that I needed at least a full day off afterwards. And it had probably better be the day after. If I wait, you know, if I had plans and appointments and I did those the next day and then took a day off, I might need a day and a half.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And when I say a day off, I mean no appointments and no coffee dates with my friends and no clients as a coach and no nothing.
Just total permission for...
I'll go get cat food at the store if I don't have any cat food. But I really don't want to have to do anything more important than that. Mm-hmm. And if I let myself have that full day, then I can jump up and do all kinds of stuff for the rest of the week. I mean, it's just turned out to be the most efficient use of my energy. But I need to be able to follow my nose. It's not as though those days I don't do anything. But it really is important to me to not have other people around because I'm very influenced by what other people are doing and what they want. So, you know, somebody calls and says, oh, let's go to this, you know, art opening and go to have dinner. And I'm really likely to say, sure. So I can't answer the phone.
Right.
You know, and I've just learned all that.
So is there a different, or how would you describe the difference in the quality of either your mental space, or maybe you have another name for it. So, like the mental space of just having a casual coffee with someone versus being at home with a cup of tea in the window, staring out at your yard.
It's completely about self-reference or outer reference, inner or outer. Mm. And I think that as a culture, we've almost completely lost the inner references. I think that's what a lot of meditation practices and things that people do. I mean, there's a lot of focus on how do you regain that inner sense of yourself, of what you want, of what you know, of what you believe, the trust in those things. I just think people a century ago had so much more time and were so much more reliant on themselves in a way that our current culture does not promote at all, ever. I mean, our current culture is about pay attention to the outside because then we can sell you something. I'm not talking about businesses of the kind that you and I are discussing. It's really the big motor of the culture is buy health insurance, buy car insurance, buy a better car. Don't practice your trumpet and spend that time for yourself. but do a job that makes money so you can buy a better version of the car that you already has that runs fine. I mean, it's all that motivation and badgering, which we don't even notice anymore.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Until we sit home alone all day long looking out the window. And then suddenly it's a shock when you go outside again or you look at a magazine in the line at the grocery store.
Right. Yeah, grocery stores can be quite jarring.
Oh, you must be having an amazing time having come back from foreign climes.
I didn't even have a kitchen. I didn't even go to grocery stores. It was great. It was that was one of the things that I very much appreciate about that lifestyle is obviously there's advertising everywhere,
yeah.
Externally, but some of that kind of micro like messaging that we get from magazines, because they're brilliant marketers.
Yeah.
Like brilliant. So to just kind of be free of that for a while is pretty sweet. I'm still kind of wondering about this sense of like, how do you know? How do you know it's enough? Is there a different quality of sense of self that you experience to know that you've had enough time off, or to know, like, maybe even midway through the day if you're out and about and you have a choice of either going to do this, it's not a set appointment, it's an optional, or to go back. What are you referencing in yourself to make the decision, you know what, I thought I was going to want to go to this thing, but
I'm not ready yet.
Yeah.
It's all physical. It's all about enthusiasm and energy. I mean, I can have one of those blank days where I'm by myself and I don't go out, and I, you know, I'm not watching television. I don't read that many novels anymore. Even I don't even know what I'm doing. I know I should probably write it down one day and figure out if I can tell anyone what really happens.
Mm-hmm.
But if I've had a full day like that, I am so ready to go the next day. Mm-hmm. I have so much energy. I have so much enthusiasm. I have so much. Oh, what's a good word? Just joy, cheerfulness, ready to roll. Hmm. You know, I'm not resentful of anything. I'm not mad at anybody. And I live a pretty unmelodramatic life these days. I've learned a lot about taking that stuff away.
What?
And boy, there's nothing that improves your creativity more than lack of melodrama. It's really great.
Oh, nice.
Yes. Yeah. So it has to do with learning who you are and how you behave. And, oh, yeah, of course I feel this way. I just, you know, took an hour off instead of a whole day. I'm going to be irritable, cranky, not listening well, not as present to my friends. I mean, it's sort of a waste of all of our times.
Hmm. Which brings me to my big question, because the name of this podcast is Authentic Success.
Uh-huh.
And so much of what I hear you saying, surprise, is that it's not the financial, you know, the external financial and material indicators that are driving you, but healthy you, healthy sense and good relationships, and how can you bring your best self to your work and your friends and your community. So what do you have? Do you have a definition of what authentic success means for you?
Hmm. I don't think I separate authentic success from authenticity.
Hmm.
I think my failures are equally authentic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to be. And I do this with my clients, and I do this with my poetry students, and with everybody I can get my hands on. I'm trying to be the molliest Molly I can be. I'm trying to distill myself down to the most authentic version of myself I can get to. And that takes a lot of layers. It takes a lot of unpacking. It takes a lot of sorting out, and sometimes you change, and then you have to figure out how to accommodate that part. So, I would say that my idea of authentic success is authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a little bit circular, but I don't think it's too circular. Sometimes I say to myself or to other people, is this the kind of thing that Molly would do? Well, oh, so why am I doing it exactly? Some other reason, you know? Okay, get rid of that, whatever it is.
Right.
Phase that one out.
Or opens up the question for it. What is the motivation here? Like, right. Why was I even thinking of going in this direction, maybe?
And right.
Is there something else that I'm not acknowledging at face value? Which is very vague. But
for me, I had a huge, huge, huge piece of this around being discovered as a writer. You know, the John Updike thing was a big deal in the family. I was raised in a milieu where publishers found writers and promoted them. And that is not how the world is right now. So, for instance, last spring, right around this time when I was deciding that I wanted to bring out my own book and self-publish Blow Drying a Chicken, it took me quite a while to manage the part of myself that was absolutely Cinderella pissed off not to be discovered. And I think that's a class thing. I think it has to do with growing up as Updike's niece. I think there's probably a generational thing about it. I mean, there's lots of different influences. And I was really fascinated, finally, when I got down to the point where I was saying to myself, you've always been an entrepreneur. Why wouldn't you be entrepreneurial here? You've always disliked and distrusted the culture. Why are you thinking the culture is right here? It's like, look at all the different things you stand for and see how come you're so attached to this one thing that is against all that stuff. It's like, what's going on here?
Right.
And that's how you find out the things in yourself that are ripe for change and get a chance to grow. It's when, you know, 90% of your personality is heading east and 10% is standing there with a suitcase saying, I am not moving unless we're going west.
Hands on hips, heels dug in.
Exactly.
Now, how long did it take for you to go through that process and then come to terms with you publishing your own book?
Well, there's two answers to that. One is it probably took from 1990 when I started writing until 2013 in March.
Nice.
But really, once I got to the point where I could answer the question, I didn't come up with those questions myself. I had some help from friends saying, this doesn't really make sense. Mm. My coach helped me with this, a bunch of other people, and I couldn't hear them for years. And then finally I could hear them.
Okay.
And I'm not sure what the difference is, except that stuff takes time.
Right. Wow, nice. Okay, I'm taking a look at the time,
okay.
And I think our time is about up. So do you have any final advice for people to help them bring forth their own authenticity that can lead to happier days and more success for them?
I think the thing that's really important, the two things I think are really important to think about. One of them is nobody knows the answer to this question but you. What does authenticity mean for you? You've got the answer and no one else does. So you somehow have to put yourself in a position where you can let the answer unfold without having other people push you back and forth. Having said that, life is very complicated. And I think we have a whole bunch of different conflicting opinions about things. So one of the things that it's taken me a while to learn how to do is to manage the conflicts inside myself so that I can come to a place that says, this is really me. You know, yes, I want to stay home tonight, and yes, I want to go out. And if I stay home, I'll probably cry because I wanted to go out. But that doesn't mean I shouldn't have stayed home. And I might go out and, you know, be standing there among all these friends and think, darn it, I wish I was by myself. And you kind of just have to, I mean, our culture really proposes that there's one good, strong answer to every question. And I just don't find that in my experience at all. There's a ton of confusion.
Right.
And if you can help yourself understand that that's not bad and it's not something to fix, it's just something to kind of go through, I think it helps your vision a lot, both in terms of how you envision yourself as an authentic person and how you envision getting yourself through the world doing this wonderful entrepreneurial job you want to be doing.
Love that, Molly. Love it, love it, love it. Thank you. Thank
you're
you.
You're welcome.
Where can people find more of you online?
Oh, mollyfisk.com. Okay. Which is currently under construction, but it won't be next week. It'll be done.
Oh, great. Oh, yeah. Oh, super. I look forward to seeing that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll put a link to that in the great. Show notes.
Great, great.
And thank you so, so, so much for having this conversation with me.
It was really fun.
Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with poet Molly Fisk as much as I did. The link to her website will be in the show notes. Until the next time, stay authentic.